Met. I'm Pam Bryant. Nice to meet you. I am from Howard Payne University, small liberal arts, very conservative college in the heart of Texas. And that just because we live there doesn't mean that we don't strive to find wisdom, but in trying to strive to find wisdom, we want to glorify and serve God in the process. So I was trying to determine the size of God. My students seem to compartmentalize God. So it kind of cuts off. Well, this is, so we have this world we call our home, and there's my home, and the mountains, which I love. And then we have our world, which has a home. It happens to be in the Milky Way galaxy, and if you get lost, we're right out there on one of the arms. So we can't decide whether it's the Orion arm or the Perseus arm, but it's in one of those. But we try to comprehend these things in our world. And the way we comprehend them is we actually try to measure them in some way and then compare them to things that we see, can feel, and know. And so we take and we have all kinds of measurements for everything. But we understand the mountain and the trees, and we can see it, we can feel it, we can go there. And this is my favorite picture because I can see my grandson on my favorite old horse named Bones, because my husband got him from the, where you go, and this old horse came through when he was buying and selling cows, and it was just a bag of bones. And we took him and fed him all up, and he was just wonderful. And my dog, I can see, I can feel, I can love those things in my home. But yet, as a scientist, I want to know more. I want to see more. I want to understand more. I have this thirst, this hunger for knowledge. And so what do we as scientists do? We try to delve into the unknown by using telescopes and microscopes so that we can bring that unknown and make it ours and begin to know what that unknown is. And then, in order to really understand it, we assign size to it. And here's a meter. One of my friends gave me this. Let's see, 39.37. He gave me inches, and I needed a meter because I had a yardstick and it wouldn't fit in the suitcase. But about this much is a meter. So then, what is a centimeter? Oh, it's about, well, that's an inch. So what is 2.54, you know, would take about a half. That's your centimeter, and then your millimeter is like even down further, and then, you know, divide that, and you get your micrometer, and then keep going until you get down to this silly old 10 to the minus 24. You know, how do we understand what that is? Okay, or we go higher. So if we don't have size, we don't understand what's going on. So what is this great, fantastic picture? I don't know. Why don't I know? Because I don't know its size. I have nothing that I can compare it to. But then if I were to tell you it's this great big huge thing that happens to be 9.46 times 10 to the 15 meters, oh, it's the Oort cloud, the giant bubble that our whole solar system is sitting in. Then I begin to comprehend what it was I was looking at. Well, by comparing it with things I know, I have the Oort cloud, and I have bubble on the centimeter scale, and then I have, you know, cool buckyball. This thing was really hard to put together. I don't know how God did it that fast. But anyway, here's a buckyball, which is, you know, your C60, your carbon, and so we can get down to the molecular scale, and you're more like with molecules on the nanometer scale. So we know in our world that we're surrounded by things that we can see and things that are unseen. You know, I can see the stars, I can see a lake, and I can see the sand. But, you know, there's really unseen things. There's galaxy, all right, up in the stars somewhere, and there's fish in the ocean. And then, as a chemist, I know that water is H2O and sand is silicon dioxide. So I can begin to bring the unseen closer to my own reality. And then I can get way out in the deepest, dark, of theory and say, oh, well, you know, there's a possibility that there's this realm that's really not measurable with what I'm talking about. And one of those possibilities, there's many, but I just picked string theory because I thought it was cool. And that matter is not really particles or particulate at all. It's waves vibrating. And those vibrations then compare to the different elementary particles. And you have open strings and closed strings, you know, and some correspond to the electron and some to the other things. And that they're, oh, forget, it's so small that three-dimensional space doesn't really, it doesn't work. So then they're down to, what, 11 dimensions or more now. And this is just Jeff Bryant did this nice little animation with Mathematica. And what is so cool is you think of those vibrating strings as a symphonic band, and it generates music, and each string participates in the music. And then what is the symphony? It's matter. And I think that's just a really cool analogy. That's why I like string theory, well, and other reasons. But then we can get a little higher, which things we can understand a little bit better. And we can get to the quark. And then you have, you know, your strange and your charms. And the proton is two up and one down. Neutron is one up and two down. And here's a nice, neat artist rendition of a carbon nucleus with protons and neutrons showing the quarks. We've never seen a quark, but the CERN is really trying to understand these, so they took and have accelerated protons and smashed them into other protons. And with that, with the results that they see, they're beginning to study the hadrons, which contain the quarks, which are what things are made out of. And so we have the atom. You know, we really are beginning to get on the femtometer scale. And it contains, the nucleus contains the protons and neutrons, and the electrons really aren't running around, you know, like in orbits. It's kind of this electron cloud that has specific probabilities of where it is located. And then we have neutrons. We've never really seen the protons. We haven't seen the neutrons, but we know the nucleus is powerfully explosive, and we have had things like neutron bombs and atomic bombs. And so we know the results of what happens to the nucleus, even though we haven't seen it. And we're still down there on the femtometer scale. Well, thank goodness for all these fancy things. With the scanning, tunneling microscopes, we've now begun to see the atom itself. This is the first time that we can actually see the things in real life. Well, you know, through these huge, not huge, but fancy instruments. And now we're on about the picometer scale. It's what we can really see, and we can bring that invisible realm to our comprehension. And so we're limited only by what we can see by our imagination, by our critical thinking and our scientific reasoning. And if we can comprehend the smallness, then we can actually make it useful. And here's a memristor by Hewlett-Packard. And in this image, the wire is about 150 atoms wide. And soon, we will be able to get terabytes of information on about a centimeter square. Oh, that is not very big. You know, take about that much square. Terabyte of information. I mean, it's phenomenal. And that will be coming soon. All right, not only that, but, you know, when you have grad students, and this was at Rice University. I'm sorry, half the stuff is cutting off up there. But at Rice University, they have taken buckyballs and arranged them and actually made a small car out of molecules. And so then what do scientists do with something like the buckyball? Well, they created nanotubes. And from those nanotubes, they found out that they were, what, about 20 times the strength of steel, 50% lighter than aluminum, and durable to temperatures of about 2,000 degrees. Well, what have they done with those nanotubes as scientists? They've actually made them stronger. And then what do we as scientists do, or the engineers, as you imagine, what can you do with these things? So some of the imaginations that are actually happening in designs that are actually in design, they are not done yet, are making elevators to space. Now, forget about the old rockets and the environmental concerns with that. But with the nanotubes, They're really strong enough to be anchored to the Earth and go into geosynchronous orbit and latch at zero, geosynchronous orbit with some kind of space station. And so scientists and researchers are actually working on those things now. Then what have scientists done? They've taken and made nanobuds. What are nanobuds? Take a buckle ball, add a nanotube to it, and you're saying, oh, what on earth does that have to do with anything? Well, without the scientists who did this, we wouldn't have the cheap, inexpensive flat-screen TVs that we have, or the less expensive electron microscopes that research groups can now have. So we're getting on to the level, and this is some of the stuff that I help with at where I was before. And they make nanowires, and these are silver nanowires, and they're about 50 nanometers apart. And they've gotten to where they're very, very accurate, and they're actually thinking about using these for neural prosthetic pieces. In fact, here is an artist's rendition of artificial brain cells. And we're still on the nanometer scale, 10 to the minus 9, and where each brain bot houses a computer that contains enough information as a large library or instruments for surface thoughts. And you think, oh, this is way in the future. I'm sorry. I mean, there are things out there for quadriplegic and tetraplegic people who actually have implants in their brains now that are their own testing. All right, and then what else can they do? You know, this is not scary. This is not evil. This is just what we as scientists can work on. Rather than working with stem cells, which are very controversial, they have enough information now to begin to start making little robots or little machines that can then move around blood cells to help cure cancers and diabetes, you know, where they actually give insulin injections. So these nanobots may lead to things, and yes, researchers are starting to work on things like this. And here's a gear that is made at the Sandia Labs, and each cog is about 4 nanometers, and the whole gear itself is half the diameter of a human hair. I mean, we have become amazing as scientists on this nanometer level. You know, we think, wow, we are finally getting there. And then, as impressive as the nanotechnology is, look at this common dust mite. All right? The dust mite is about the size of a dot on the page. And there's that gear. And we don't even compare yet. All right? And those nanobots that we think finally, after all this time of working, there are nanobots in our body right now, plain old bacteria, and they can run around with their little tails and do good things and bad things, all right? And that is actually an example of a cholera bacteria like it was in Haiti. And we thought, as scientists, that we were so cool about making the nanotubes that I was just talking to you about a few minutes ago. Well, there are bacteria that have been making those nanotubes for I don't know how long. All right, and they are Swanala bacteria, and they're the little blue things that you see up there, greenish looking from there. And they're on the micrometer scale, and they can actually make the superconducting nanotubes that I was talking to you about that we got from the Buckyball research. And so we study, or scientists study, the nanoelectronic devices to see better ways just from what's in those. Now, this is what's amazing. Let me find it. I have to put it in here so I don't lose it. This is what I got from Mother's Day. And it goes in my cell phone, and I have a big picture of it up here. It holds 32 gigabytes. And I can put it in my droid, my cell phone, and it's just a little chip, you know, that's in the back. I can watch 720 hours of movies or about 12,000 photographs. The technology is here, and I want y'all to understand. It only cost about $80. Right? So the circuitry on this microchip is about 10 times bigger than E. coli. So, wow, haven't we come a long ways? Don't y'all agree? I mean, I can 720 hours of movies. Well, here's E. coli. The circuitry on this microchip, even though it's about 10 times bigger than an E. coli computes 1,000 times faster. Its memory density is 100 million times higher, and it only needs about a millionth of the power. So, that's, y'all get that? That's like cool. Right? We think we're so good, but look what our Creator does. All right, let's get bigger. I've done nano enough. So we'll get to pollen. And pollen's on the micrometer scale between 20 and 60 micrometers. Even if we can't necessarily see it, our noses sure can. And here's human hair. And it's about 50 micrometers in diameter. But look what scientists have done. Here, a student at McMaster University actually wrote the name on a human hair. Can you see that? And so let's go back here. All right, and then we can get to bacteria, the blue-green algae, which is a problem right now in Texas because we have such a drought. And then fleas are kind of a problem. We're about 1 to 9 millimeters now. Then ants are still in the millimeter. We can get to the centimeter scale with a honeybee. And then we get to an apple. And an apple is, I don't know, how big is this apple? We'll go this way. About 3 inches, also about 7 centimeters, give or take a centimeter. About 7 centimeters in diameter. But if you remove all the empty space from all the 6 billion plus people in the world, you could fit them in this apple with room left over. All right? Because the atoms must fill empty space. So, our human curiosity knows no limits. With the new theories and discoveries, we can go from string theory to the quark that we can't see, to the protons and neutrons, to finally the atoms we can see, to the apple which we can touch and feel and understand. Okay, I raised some miniature donkeys. Donkeys are about 70 centimeters high. Then the blue whale is the biggest animal. Blue whale is about 33.6 meters long. What is a meter? It's about 39. About here. You know, what am I? Almost, not quite. A meter and a half. It'd take a whole bunch of me to make a blue whale. But they're about 33.6 meters long. A human can be almost 2 meters tall. And here's just an example of the blue whale. And here is Old Main. It's a large building at Howard Payne. And I have students try and figure out its size. And they have to take a protractor and a piece of string and a washer and go out there and figure its size. And then compare it to the Statue of Liberty. Sometimes we do the Eiffel Tower. Okay, the Statue of Liberty. If you'll notice, the Statue of Liberty would just, our Old Main Tower would just fit like in this piece of the Statue of Liberty. And so the Statue of Liberty at 93 meters is pretty high. But Enchanted Rock in Texas, because everything's big in Texas, this great big huge piece of granite, is about 1,200 kilometers high. We think it's like cool big. And Statue of Liberty is nothing compared to Enchanted Rock. But then, if you compare Enchanted Rock to Mount Everest, which is 8,800 kilometers high, the largest mountain on Earth, then Enchanted Rock isn't very big. And here is Mount Everest. But then if we compare Mount Everest to the planets, then Mount Everest isn't that big. And now we're on the megameter scale. All right? And here's the moon for comparison. The moon is about 400 times wider in diameter than Mount Everest. But yet, the moon is smaller than Mercury, even. And if I were to take 100 Mount Everests and stack them end to end, then it's just like a whisker on the Earth. And I don't know, can you see flashing up there right on the Nepal border? So it would be really hard to see, even if I were to take 100 Mount Everests high. And then we can get out in the megameter scale. We've got mercury about 4.5 megameters. And the messenger zoomed in 2008 and actually gave us kilometer size detail from mercury. And if we go to Venus, we had the Venus Express in 2005 that actually gave us and let us see the kilometer size detail on Venus. Oh, I guess you should see that. I'm going really fast. Okay. And here is Venus. And then here is Mars on the megameter scale. And Mars, there is Valles Marineris and the Hellas Basin on Mars. And then actually we had the Phoenix landed in 2008 and dug up a centimeter size amount. And we thought that it might be water, you know, frozen water, but it evaporated really soon before they can actually test it. If we go on out, then Jupiter is 14 times the diameter of the Earth. And if we get way on out here to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, then we have gone into the terameter scale, 10 to the 12th scale. And out there, Pluto, well, poor Pluto is in the Kuiper Belt, and it was demoted. It is no longer a planet. And why? Because as we as scientists learn more and more, we found out that there's lots of planets, kind of like Pluto. So it was either make them all planets or demote Pluto. So Pluto kind of got the boot. But we did find that it had several moons around it. And then we're getting to, in the pentameter scale, 10 to the 15, we get to the Oort cloud itself. And then at the center of all this is the sun. And then the sun is in your gigameter scale, and a million Earths could fit inside the sun. The sun is, like, huge. And here's just a prominence and how our Earth would fit in one of the prominences. So our Earth is really not that big, and our sun is huge. But our sun is really not that big because here's Arcturus, a star that's diameter is 23 times bigger than the sun. But I can see Arcturus with my own eyes. All I got to do is find the Big Dipper, follow the curve of the handle down, and I can arc down to Arcturus and see that little red star in the sky in Boots. And there it is. There's Arcturus, big, huge star. But Arcturus isn't really that big? No. There's Antares. Antares' diameter is 325 times bigger than the sun. In fact, it would take 50 million of our suns to fit inside the star Antares. And Antares, if I look at Scorpio in the southern sky and I find the little hook of Scorpio and follow it up to the stingers, then that red star is Antares. So Antares is huge, but Antares is really not that big. If I look with my telescope, I can see a smudge at M16, and it's right above M17, right there, right above Sagittarius. I can see M16, and that's the Eagle Nebula. All right, and the Eagle Nebula is about 25 pentameters in diameter. If I were to hone in on this pentameter 10 to the 15 and at one of the star-forming areas, and then I'm still in the pentameter, but if I hone in some more and I get right here and I look right there, that's about the size of our solar system. So the Eagle Nebula is huge. But you know what I'm going to say next? But it's not that big. Alright. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is 10 billion times bigger than the Eagle Nebula. Alright, and our sun is just one of 200 to 400 billion stars in the Milky Way. And I can see the Milky Way. All I have to do is go out in the country at night when it's dark and there's no moon. And I look up and you can just see the Milky Way. It is amazing. So take the time and go look for it for yourself. All right. And then you can see the square Pegasus, two big four. four, not two, four, four big stars. You kind of have to look way up high, you can strain your neck, and then look for the W, which is Cassiopeia, and about halfway between, you can find a little smudge right there. So I found that smudge, and I took my my husband's hunting binoculars, you know, because I'm from Texas, and used those, and looked up there. Oh my goodness, this is what I found. It was so exciting. I saw a galaxy, all right, a real-life galaxy. And, oh, you just don't understand. It just gave me this certain perspective on life and on being human and on space and the vastness and everything. Of course, my little pictures, nothing compared to the Andromeda that the Hubble could give. But still, it was like fascinating to me. And there are about 100 Messier objects that you can find with just a cheap Walmart telescope if you join an astronomy club or something like that. So the Milky Way is about that much. That is huge. Okay, and you got all those Messier objects, which I told you about. And then, so it's really big, right? Well, then what the scientists at NASA did is they took the Hubble telescope and pointed it to nothing and said, there's nothing there. And lo and behold, they let it wait and develop and wait and develop and wait and develop. And out of that nothingness came, in one little centimeter square, came thousands of galaxies. So then they moved the Hubble over a little bit to this little dark spot and got thousands of galaxies there. And then they moved it over a little bit more and got thousands of galaxies there. Oh, so we're just one of hundreds of billions of galaxies. And they actually are mapping these galaxies. So we have billions of galaxies in our universe, almost totally empty. Just like, you know, our apple and the people were almost totally empty. It's beyond our imagination. And yet the creator of this universe and all this that I've been talking about is God, who with a word spoke it into being and who is present everywhere in this universe and beyond, who upholds with all his mighty power. Great is our God and greatly to be praised. So all things came into being through him, and nothing came into being that has not come into being without him. So when you approach God today through his son Jesus, come with humility, a profound sense of wonder, and a sober understanding of his magnitude. So how big is God? Oops, I was using the wrong book then, wasn't I? He's big enough to care for me personally and to have sent his son to die for my sins. So I want to thank all the we's that I used in here, all the curious, creative, thinking, and exploring scientists, and my Howard Payne University for sending me here, my biochemistry and astronomy students are the ones who put the scriptures to the slides, my family, and my church.